Are you all right?
She catches sight of the bottle next to my bed, and her shoulders sag.
Oh, Rachel.
She comes across to my bed and picks up the bottle. I'm too embarrassed to say anything.
Are you not going into work? She asks me. Did you go yesterday?
She doesn't wait for me to answer, just turns to go, calling back as she does.
You'll end up getting yourself sacked if you carry on like this.
I should just say it now. She's already angry with me. I should go after her and tell her. I was sacked months ago for turning up blind drunk after a 3-hour lunch with a client, during which I managed to be so rude and unprofessional that I cost the firm his business. When I close my eyes, I can still remember the tail end of that lunch. The look on the waitress's face as she handed me my jacket. Weaving into the office. People turning to look. Martin Miles taking me to one side.
I think it's best if you go home now, Rachel.
There is a crack of thunder. A flash of light. I jolt upright. What was it I thought of last night? I check my little black book, but I haven't written anything down since midday yesterday. Notes about Kamal. Age. Ethnicity. Conviction for domestic violence. I pick up a pen and cross out that last point. Downstairs, I make myself a cup of coffee and turn on the TV. The police held a press conference last night. They're showing clips from it on Sky News. Detective Inspector Gaskill's up there, looking pale and gaunt and chastened. Hangdog. He never mentions Kamal's name, just says that a suspect has been detained and questioned, but has been released without charge, and that the investigation is ongoing. The cameras pan away from him to Scott, sitting hunched and uncomfortable, blinking in the light of the cameras, his face a twist of anguish. It hurts my heart to see him. He speaks softly, his eyes cast down. He says that he has not given up hope, that no matter what the police say, he still clings to the idea that Megan will come home. The words come out hollow. They ring false. But without looking into his eyes, I can't tell why. I can't tell whether he doesn't really believe she's coming home, because all the faith he once possessed has been ripped away by the events of the past few days, or because he really knows that she's never coming home. It comes to me, just then. The memory of calling his number yesterday. Once? Twice? I run upstairs to get my phone and find it tangled up in the bedclothes. I have 3 missed calls, one from Tom and 2 from Scott. No messages. The call from Tom was last night, as was the first call from Scott, but later, just before midnight. The second call from him was this morning, a few minutes ago. My heart lifts a little. This is good news. Despite his mother's actions, despite their clear implications, thank you very much for your help, now get lost. Scott still wants to talk to me. He needs me. I'm momentarily flooded with affection for Kathy, filled with gratitude to her for pouring the rest of the wine away. I have to keep a clear head for Scott. He needs me thinking straight. I take a shower, get dressed, and make another cup of coffee. And then I sit down in the living room, little black book at my side, and I call Scott.
You should have told me, he says, as soon as he picks up. What you are.
His tone is flat, cold. My stomach is a small, hard ball. He knows.
Detective Sergeant Riley spoke to me after they let him go. He denied having an affair with her. And the witness who suggested that there was something going on was unreliable, she said. An alcoholic. Possibly mentally unstable. She didn't tell me the witness's name, but I take it she was talking about you.
But... no, I say. No, I'm not. I hadn't been drinking when I saw them. It was 8:30 in the morning. Like that means anything. And they found evidence. It said so on the news. They found...
insufficient evidence.
The phone goes dead. Friday the 26th of July, 2013. Morning. I am no longer travelling to my imaginary office. I have given up the pretense. I can barely be bothered to get out of bed. I think I last brushed my teeth on Wednesday. I'm still feigning illness, although I'm pretty sure I'm fooling no one. I can't face getting up, getting dressed, getting onto the train, going into London, wandering the streets. It's hard enough when the sun is shining. It's impossible in this rain. Today is the third day of cold, driving, relentless downpour. I'm having trouble sleeping, and it's not just the drinking now. It's the nightmares. I'm trapped somewhere, and I know that someone's coming, and there's a way out. I know there is. I know that I saw it before, only I can't find my way back to it. And when he does get me, I can't scream. I try, I suck the air into my lungs and force it out, but there's no sound. Just a rasping, like a dying person fighting for air. Sometimes, in my nightmares, I find myself in the underpass by Blenheim Road. The way back is blocked, and I cannot go further because there is something there. Someone waiting, and I wake in pure terror. They're never going to find her. Every day, every hour that passes, I become more certain. She will be one of those names. Hers will be one of those stories. Lost, missing, body never found. And Scott will not have justice or peace. He will never have a body to grieve over. He will never know what happened to her. There will be no closure, no resolution. I lie awake thinking about it, and I ache. There can be no greater agony. Nothing can be more painful than the not knowing, which will never end. I have written to him. I admitted my problem. Then I lied again, saying that I had it under control, that I was seeking help. I told him that I am not mentally unstable. I no longer know whether that's true or not. I told him that I was very clear about what I saw and that I hadn't been drinking when I saw it. That at least is true. He hasn't replied. I didn't expect him to. I am cut off from him, shut out. The things I want to say to him, I can never say. I can't write them down. They don't sound right. I want him to know how sorry I am that it wasn't enough to point them in Kamal's direction. To say, look, there he is. I should have seen something. That Saturday night, I should have had my eyes open. Evening. I am soaked through, freezing cold. The ends of my fingers blanched and wrinkled, my head throbbing from a hangover that kicked in about 5:30. Which is about right, considering I started drinking before midday. I went out to get another bottle, but I was thwarted by the ATM, which gave me the much-anticipated riposte, "There are insufficient funds in your account." After that, I started walking. I walked aimlessly for over an hour, through the driving rain. The pedestrianized centre of Ashbury was mine alone. I decided, somewhere along that walk, that I have to do something. I have to make amends for being insufficient. Now, sodden and almost sober, I'm going to call Tom. I don't want to know what I did, what I said that Saturday night. But I have to find out. It might jog something. For some reason, I am certain that there is something I'm missing, something vital. Perhaps this is just more self-deception, yet another attempt to prove to myself that I'm not worthless. But perhaps it's real.
"I've been trying to get hold of you since Monday," Tom says when he answers the phone. "I called your office," he adds, and he lets that sink in.
I'm on the back foot already, embarrassed, ashamed. "I need to talk to you," I say, "about Saturday night. That Saturday night."
"What are you talking about? I need to talk to you about Monday, Rachel. What the hell were you doing at Scott Hipwell's house?"
"That's not important, Tom."
"Yes, it bloody is. What were you doing there? You do realise, don't you, that he could be... I mean, we don't know, do we?
He could have done something to her, couldn't he? To his wife.
He hasn't done anything to his wife, I say confidently. It isn't him.
How the hell would you know?
Rachel, what is going on? You have to believe me. That isn't why I called you. I needed to talk to you about that Saturday. About the message you left me. You were so angry. You said I'd scared Anna.
Well, you had. She saw you stumbling down the street. You shouted abuse at her. She was really freaked out after what happened last time. With Evie.
Did she? Did she do something?
Do something?
To me.
What?
I had a cut, Tom, on my head. I was bleeding.
Are you accusing Anna of hurting you?
He's yelling now. He's furious.
Seriously, Rachel, that is enough. I have persuaded Anna on more than one occasion not to go to the police about you. But if you carry on like this, harassing us, making up stories...
I'm not accusing her of anything, Tom. I'm just trying to figure things out.
You don't remember? Of course not. Rachel doesn't remember.
He sighs wearily.
Look, Anna saw you. You were drunk and abusive. She came home to tell me she was upset, so I went out to look for you. You were in the street. I think you might have fallen. You were very upset. You'd cut your hand.
I hadn't...
Well, you had blood on your hand then. I don't know how it got there. I told you I'd take you home, but you wouldn't listen. You were out of control. You were making no sense. You walked off and I went to get the car, but when I came back, you'd gone. I drove up past the station, but I couldn't see you. I drove around a bit more. Anna was very worried that you were hanging around somewhere, that you'd come back, that you'd try to get into the house. I was worried you'd fall or get yourself into trouble. I drove all the way to Ashbury. I rang the bell, but you weren't at home. I called you a couple of times. I left a message. And yes, I was angry. I was really pissed off by that point.
I'm sorry, Tom, I say.
I'm really sorry.
I know, he says. You're always sorry.
You said that I shouted at Anna, I say, cringing at the thought of it. What did I say to her?
I don't know,
he snaps. Would you like me to go and get her? Perhaps you'd like to have a chat with her about it. Tom, well, honestly, what does it matter now?
Did you see Megan Hipwell that night?
No.
He sounds concerned now.
Why? Did you? You didn't do something, did you?
No, of course I didn't.
He's silent for a moment.
Well, why are you asking about this then? Rachel, if you know something...
I don't know anything, I say. I didn't see anything.
Why were you at the Hipwells' house on Monday? Please tell me, so that I can put Anna's mind at ease. She's worried.
I had something to tell him. Something I thought might be useful.
You didn't see her, but you had something useful to tell him.
I hesitate for a moment. I'm not sure how much I should tell him, whether I should keep this just for Scott.
It's about Megan, I say. She was having an affair.
Wait, did you know her?
Just a little, I say.
How?
From her gallery.
Oh, he says. So who's the guy?
Her therapist, I tell him. Kamal Abdic. I saw them together.
Really? The guy they arrested? I thought they'd let him go.
They have. And it's my fault because I'm an unreliable witness.
Tom laughs. It's soft, friendly. He isn't mocking me.
Rachel, come on. You did the right thing coming forward. I'm sure it's not just about you.
In the background, I can hear the prattle of the child, and Tom says something away from the phone, something I can't hear.
I should go,
he says. I can imagine him putting down the phone, picking up his little girl, giving her a kiss, embracing his wife. The dagger in my heart twists, round and round and round. Monday the 29th of July, 2013. Morning. It's 8:07 and I'm on the train. Back to the imaginary office. Kathy was with Damien all weekend, and when I saw her last night I didn't give her a chance to berate me. I started apologizing for my behavior straight away. Said I'd been feeling really down, but that I was pulling myself together, turning over a new leaf. She accepted, or pretended to accept, my apologies. She gave me a hug. Niceness writ large. Megan has dropped out of the news almost completely. There was a comment piece in the Sunday Times about police incompetence, which referred briefly to the case. An unnamed source at the Crown Prosecution Service citing it as one of a number of cases in which the police have made a hasty arrest on the basis of flimsy or flawed evidence. We're coming to the signal. I feel the familiar rattle and jolt. The train slows and I look up, because I have to, because I cannot bear not to. But there is never anything to see any longer. The doors are closed, and the curtains drawn. There is nothing to see but rain, sheets of it, and muddy water pooling at the bottom of the garden. On a whim, I get off the train at Whitney. Tom couldn't help me, but perhaps the other man could, the red-haired man. I wait for the disembarking passengers to disappear down the steps, and then I sit on the only covered bench on the platform. I might get lucky. I might see him getting onto the train. I could follow him. I could talk to him. It's the only thing I have left. My last roll of the dice. If this doesn't work, I have to let it go. I just have to let it go. Half an hour goes by. Every time I hear footsteps on the steps, my heart rate goes up. Every time I hear the clacking of high heels, I am seized with trepidation. If Anna sees me here, I could be in trouble. Tom warned me. He's persuaded her not to get the police involved, but if I carry on... 9:15. Unless he starts work very late, I've missed him. It's raining harder now, and I can't face another aimless day in London. The only money I have is a tenner I borrowed from Kathy, and I need to make that last until I've summoned up the courage to ask my mother for a loan. I walk down the steps, intending to cross underneath to the opposite platform and go back to Ashbury, when suddenly I spot Scott hurrying out of the newsagent opposite the station entrance, his coat pulled up around his face. I run after him and catch him at the corner right opposite the underpass. I grab his arm and he wheels round, startled. "Please," I say, "can I talk to you?"
"Jesus Christ," he snarls at me. "What the fuck do you want?"
I back away from him, holding my hands up. "I'm sorry," I say. "I'm sorry. I just wanted to apologize, to explain." The downpour has become a deluge. We are the only people on the street, both of us soaked to the skin. Scott starts to laugh. He throws his hands up in the air and roars with laughter.
"Come to the house," he says. "We're going to drown out here."
Scott goes upstairs to fetch me a towel while the kettle boils. The house is less tidy than it was a week ago, the disinfectant smell displaced by something earthier. A pile of newspapers sits in the corner of the living room. There are dirty mugs on the coffee table and the mantelpiece. Scott appears at my side, proffering the towel.
"It's a tip, I know. My mother was driving me insane, cleaning, tidying up after me all the time. We had a bit of a row. She hasn't been round for a few days."
His mobile phone starts to ring. He glances at it, puts it back in his pocket.
"Speak of the devil. She never bloody stops."
I follow him into the kitchen. "I'm so sorry about what happened," I say. He shrugs.
"I know. And it's not your fault anyway. I mean, it might have helped if you weren't..."
"If I wasn't a drunk?" His back is turned. He's pouring the coffee.
"Well, yes. But they didn't actually have enough to charge him with anything anyway."
He hands me the mug, and we sit down at the table. I notice that one of the photograph frames on the sideboard has been turned face down. Scott is still talking.
"They found things. Hair, skin cells, in his house. But he doesn't deny that she went there. Well, he did deny it at first. Then he admitted that she had been there."
"Why did he lie?"
"Exactly. He admitted that she'd been to the house twice, just to talk. He won't say what about. There's the whole confidentiality thing.
The hair and the skin cells were found downstairs. Nothing up in the bedroom. He swears blind they weren't having an affair. But he's a liar, so...
He passes his hand over his eyes. His face looks as though it is sinking into itself. His shoulders sag. He looks shrunken.
There was a trace of blood on his car.
Oh, my God!
Yeah. Matches her blood type. They don't know if they can get any DNA because it's such a small sample. It could be nothing. That's what they keep saying. How could it be nothing that her blood's on his car?
He shakes his head.
You were right. The more I hear about this guy, the more I'm sure.
He looks at me, right at me, for the first time since we got here.
He was fucking her, and she wanted to end it. So he did something. That's it. I'm sure of it.
He's lost all hope, and I don't blame him. It's been more than 2 weeks, and she hasn't turned on her phone, hasn't used a credit card, hasn't withdrawn money from an ATM. No one has seen her. She is gone.
He told the police that she might have run away,
Scott says. Dr. Abditch did. Scott nods.
He told the police that she was unhappy with me and she might have run off.
He's trying to shift suspicion, get them to think that you did something.
I know that. But they seem to buy everything that bastard says. That Riley woman, I can tell when she talks about him. She likes him. The poor downtrodden refugee.
He hangs his head, wretched.
Maybe he's right. We did have that awful fight. But I can't believe. She wasn't unhappy with me. She wasn't. She wasn't.
When he says it the third time, I wonder whether he's trying to convince himself.
But if she was having an affair, she must have been unhappy. Mustn't she?
Not necessarily, I say. Perhaps it was one of those, what do they call it, transference things? That's the word they use, isn't it? When a patient develops feelings, or thinks they develop feelings, for a therapist, only the therapist is supposed to resist them, to point out that the feelings aren't real. His eyes are on my face, but I feel as though he isn't really listening to what I'm saying.
What happened?
He asks.
With you? You left your husband. Was there someone else?
I shake my head. Other way round. Anna happened.
Sorry.
He pauses. I know what he's going to ask. So before he can, I say, it started before, while we were still married. The drinking. That's what you wanted to know, isn't it? He nods again. We were trying for a baby, I say, and my voice catches. Still, after all this time, every time I talk about it, the tears come to my eyes. Sorry.
It's all right.
He gets to his feet, goes over to the sink, and pours me a glass of water. He puts it on the table in front of me. I clear my throat, try to be as matter-of-fact as possible. We were trying for a baby, and it didn't happen. I became very depressed, and I started to drink. I was extremely difficult to live with, and Tom sought solace elsewhere. And she was all too happy to provide it.
I'm really sorry, that's awful. I know. I wanted to have a child. Megan kept saying she wasn't ready yet.
Now it's his turn to wipe the tears away.
It's one of the things. We argued about it sometimes.
Was that what you were arguing about the day she left? He sighs, pushing his chair back and getting to his feet.
No,
he says, turning away from me.
It was something else.
Evening. Kathy is waiting for me when I get home. She's standing in the kitchen, aggressively drinking a glass of water. Good day at the office? She asks, pursing her lips. She knows. Kathy, Damien had a meeting near Euston today. On his way out, he bumped into Martin Miles. They know each other a little, remember? From Damien's days at Lang Fund Management. Martin used to do the PR for them. Kathy. She held her hand up, took another gulp of water. You haven't worked there in months. In months. Do you know how idiotic I feel? What an idiot Damien felt. Please, please tell me that you have another job that you just haven't told me about. Please tell me that you haven't been pretending to go to work. That you haven't been lying to me day in, day out, all this time.
I didn't know how to tell you.
You didn't know how to tell me? How about, Kathy, I got fired because I was drunk at work. How about that?
I flinch, and her face softens.
I'm sorry, but honestly, Rachel...
She really is too nice.
What have you been doing? Where'd you go? What do you do all day?
I walk. Go to the library. Sometimes.
You go to the pub?
Sometimes.
But why didn't you tell me?
She approaches me, placing her hands on my shoulders.
You should have told me.
I was ashamed,
I say, and I start to cry. It's awful, cringeworthy, but I start to weep. I sob and sob, and poor Kathy holds me, strokes my hair, tells me I'll be all right, that everything will be all right. I feel wretched. I hate myself almost more than I ever have. Later, sitting on the sofa with Kathy, drinking tea, she tells me how it's going to be. I'm going to stop drinking. I'm going to get my CV in order. I'm going to contact Martin Miles and beg for a reference. I'm going to stop wasting money going backwards and forwards to London on pointless train journeys.
Honestly, Rachel, I don't understand how you could have kept this up for so long.
I shrug.
In the morning, I take the 8:04, and in the evening, I come back on the 17:56. That's my train. It's the one I take. That's the way it is.
Thursday the 1st of August, 2013. Morning.
There's something covering my face. I can't breathe. I'm suffocating. When I surface into wakefulness, I'm gasping for air, and my chest hurts. I sit up, eyes wide, and see something moving in the corner of the room. A dense center of blackness which keeps growing, and I almost cry out. And then I'm properly awake and there's nothing there. But I am. Sitting up in bed, and my cheeks are wet with tears. It's almost dawn. The light outside is just beginning to tinge grey, and the rain of the last several days is still battering against the window. I won't go back to sleep, not with my heart hammering in my chest so much it hurts. I think, though I can't be sure, that there's some wine downstairs. I don't remember finishing the second bottle. It'll be warm, because I can't leave it in the fridge. If I do, Kathy pours it away. She so badly wants me to get better. But so far, things are not going according to her plan. There's a little cupboard in the hallway where the gas meter is. If there was any wine left, I'll have stashed it in there. I creep out onto the landing and tiptoe down the stairs in the half light. I flip the little cupboard open and lift out the bottle. It's disappointingly light, not much more than a glassful in there. But better than nothing. I pour it into a mug, just in case Kathy comes down, I can pretend it's tea, and put the bottle in the bin, making sure to conceal it under a milk carton and a crisp packet. In the living room, I flick on the TV, mute it straight away, and sit down on the sofa. I'm flicking through channels. It's all children's TV and infomercials, until with a flash of recognition, I'm looking at Corley Wood, which is just down the road from here. You can see it from the train. Corley Wood in pouring rain, the fields between the tree line and train tracks submerged. I don't know why it takes me so long to realise what's going on. For 10 seconds, 15, 20... I'm looking at cars and blue and white tape and a white tent in the background, and my breath is coming shorter and shorter until I'm holding it and not breathing at all. It's her. She's been in the wood all along, just along the railway track from here. I've been past those fields every day, morning and evening, travelling by, oblivious. In the wood. I imagine a grave dug beneath scrubby bushes, hastily covered up. I imagine worse things. Impossible things.
her body hanging from a rope somewhere deep in the forest where nobody goes. It might not even be her. It might be something else. I know it isn't something else. There's a reporter on screen now, dark hair slick against his skull. I turn up the volume and listen to him tell me what I already know, what I can feel, that it wasn't me who couldn't breathe. It was Megan.
That's right,
he's saying, talking to someone in the studio, his hand pressed to his ear. The police have now confirmed that the body of a young woman has been found submerged in floodwater in a field at the bottom of Corley Wood, which is less than 5 miles from the home of Megan Hipwell. And Mrs. Hipwell, as you know, went missing in early July, the 13th of July, in fact, and has not been seen since. Police are saying that the body, which was discovered by dog walkers out early this morning, has yet to be formally identified. However, they do believe that this is Megan that they found. Mrs. Hipwell's husband has been informed. He stops speaking for a while. The news anchor is asking him a question, but I can't hear it, because the blood is roaring in my ears. I bring the mug up to my lips and drink every last drop. The reporter is talking again.
Yes, Kay, that's right. It would appear that the body was buried here in the woods, possibly for some time, and that it has been uncovered by the heavy rains that we've had recently.
It's worse. So much worse than I imagined. I can see her now. Her ruined face in the mud. Pale arms exposed, reaching up, rising up as though she were clawing her way out of the grave. I taste hot liquid, bile and bitter wine in my mouth, and I run upstairs to be sick. Evening. I stayed in bed most of the day. I tried to get things straight in my head. I tried to piece together, from the memories and the flashbacks and the dreams, what happened on Saturday night. In an attempt to make sense of it, to see it clearly, I wrote it all down. The scratching of my pen on paper felt like someone whispering to me. It put me on edge. I kept feeling as though there was someone else in the flat, just on the other side of the door, and I couldn't stop imagining her. I was almost too afraid to open the bedroom door, but when I did, there was no one there, of course. I went downstairs and turned on the television again. The same pictures were still there. The woods in the rain, police cars driving along a muddy track, that horrible white tent, all of it a grey blur. And then suddenly, Megan, smiling at the camera, still beautiful, untouched. Then it's Scott, head down, fending off photographers as he tries to get through his own front door, Riley at his side. Then it's Kamal's office. No sign of him, though. I didn't want to hear the soundtrack, but I had to turn the volume up, anything to stop the silence ringing in my ears. The police say that the woman, still not formally identified, has been dead for some time. Possibly several weeks. They say the cause of death has yet to be established. They say that there is no evidence of a sexual motive for the killing. That strikes me as a stupid thing to say. I know what they mean. They mean they don't think she was raped, which is a blessing, of course. But that doesn't mean there wasn't a sexual motive. It seems to me that Kamal wanted her and he couldn't have her. That she must have tried to end it and he couldn't stand it. That's a sexual motive, isn't it? I can't bear to watch the news any longer. So I go back upstairs and crawl under my duvet. I empty out my handbag, looking through my notes scribbled on bits of paper. All the scraps of information I've gleaned. The memories shifting like shadows. And I wonder, why am I doing this? What purpose does it serve?
Megan. Thursday the 13th of June, 2013. Morning. I can't sleep in this heat. Invisible bugs crawl over my skin, I have a rash on my chest, I can't get comfortable. And Scott seems to radiate warmth. Lying next to him is like lying next to a fire. I can't get far enough away from him and find myself clinging to the edge of the bed, sheets thrown back. It's intolerable. I thought about going to lie down on the futon in the spare room, but he hates to wake and find me gone. It always leads to a row about something. Alternative uses for the spare room, usually, or who I was thinking about while I was lying there alone. Sometimes I want to scream at him, just let me go, let me go, let me breathe. So I can't sleep, and I'm angry. I feel as though we're having a fight already, even though the fight's only in my imagination. And in my head, thoughts go round and round and round. I feel like I'm suffocating. When did this house become so bloody small? When did my life become so boring? Is this really what I wanted? I can't remember. All I know is that a few months ago I was feeling better, and now I can't think and I can't sleep and I can't draw, and the urge to run is becoming overwhelming. At night, when I lie awake, I can hear it. Quiet, but unrelenting, undeniable, a whisper in my head. Slip away. When I close my eyes, my head is filled with images of past and future lives, the things I dreamed I wanted, the things I had and threw away. I can't get comfortable, because every way I turn, I run into dead ends. The closed gallery, the houses on this road, the stifling attentions of the tedious Pilates women, the track at the end of the garden with its trains, always taking someone else to somewhere else, reminding me over and over and over, a dozen times a day, that I'm staying put. I feel as though I'm going mad. And yet, just a few months ago, I was feeling better. I was getting better. I was fine. I was sleeping. I didn't live in fear of the nightmares. I could breathe. Yes, I still wanted to run away, sometimes, but not every day. Talking to Kamal helped me. There's no denying that. I liked it. I liked him. He made me happier. And now all that feels so unfinished. I never got to the crux of it. That's my fault, of course, because I behaved stupidly like a child, because I didn't like feeling rejected. I need to learn to lose a little better. I'm embarrassed now. Ashamed. My face goes hot at the thought of it. I don't want that to be his final impression of me. I want him to see me again. To see me better. And I do feel that if I went to him, he would help. He's like that. I need to get to the end of the story. I need to tell someone. Just once. Say the words. Out loud. If it doesn't come out of me, it'll eat me up. The hole inside me, the one they left, it'll just get bigger and bigger. Until it consumes me. I'm going to have to swallow my pride and my shame and go to him. He's going to have to listen. I'll make him. Evening. Scott thinks I'm at the cinema with Tara. I've been outside Kamal's flat for 15 minutes, psyching myself up to knock on the door. I'm so afraid of the way he's going to look at me after last time. I have to show him that I'm sorry, so I've dressed the part. Plain and simple. Jeans and t-shirt, hardly any makeup. This is not about seduction. He has to see that. I can feel my heart starting to race as I step up to his front door and press the bell. No one comes. The lights are on, but no one comes. Perhaps he's seen me outside lurking. Perhaps he's upstairs, just hoping that if he ignores me, I'll go away. I won't. He doesn't know how determined I can be. Once I've made my mind up, I'm a force to be reckoned with. I ring again, and then a third time, and finally, I hear footsteps on the stairs and the door opens. He's wearing tracksuit bottoms and a white t-shirt. He's barefoot, wet-haired, his face flushed. Megan. Surprised, but not angry, which is a good start. Are you all right? Is everything all right? I'm sorry, I say. And he steps back to let me in. I feel a rush of gratitude so strong it feels almost like love. He shows me into the kitchen. It's a mess. Washing up piled on the counter and in the sink. empty takeaway cartons spilling out of the bin. I wonder if he's depressed. I stand in the doorway. He leans against the counter opposite me, his arms folded across his chest.
"What can I do for you?" he asks.
His face is arranged into a perfectly neutral expression. His therapist's face. It makes me want to pinch him, just to make him smile. "I have to tell you..." I start. And then I stop because I can't just plunge straight into it. I need a preamble. So I change tack. "I wanted to apologize," I say, "for what happened last time."
"That's okay," he says. "Don't worry about that. If you need to talk to someone, I can refer you to someone else, but I can't..."
"Please, Kamal."
"Megan, I can't counsel you any longer."
I know that, but I can't start over with someone else. I can't. We got so far. We were so close. I just have to tell you just once, and then I'll be gone, I promise. I won't ever bother you again." He cocks his head to one side. He doesn't believe me, I can tell. He thinks that if he lets me back in now, he'll never be rid of me. "Hear me out. Please, this isn't going to go on forever. I just need someone to listen."
"Your husband?" he asks, and I shake my head.
I can't tell him. Not after all this time. He wouldn't be able to see me as me any longer. I'd be someone else to him. He wouldn't know how to forgive me. Please, Kamal, if I don't spit out the poison, I feel like I'll never sleep. As a friend, not a therapist, please listen." His shoulders drop a little as he turns away, and I think it's over. My heart sinks. Then he opens a cupboard and pulls out two tumblers.
"As a friend, then, would you like some wine?"
He shows me into the living room. Dimly lit by standard lamps, it has the same air of domestic neglect as the kitchen. We sit down on opposite sides of a glass table piled high with papers, magazines, and takeaway menus. My hands are locked around my glass. I take a sip. It's red, but cold, dusty. I swallow, take another sip. He's waiting for me to start, but it's hard. Harder than I thought it was going to be. I've kept this secret for so long. A decade. More than a third of my life. It's not that easy letting go of it. I just know that I have to start talking. If I don't do it now, I might never have the courage to say the words out loud. I might lose them altogether. They might stick in my throat and choke me in my sleep. After I left Ipswich, I moved in with Mac into his cottage outside Hocombe at the end of the lane. I told you that, didn't I? It was very isolated, a couple of miles to the nearest neighbour, couple more to the nearest shops. At the beginning, we had lots of parties. There were always a few people crashed out in the living room or sleeping in the hammock outside in the summer. But we got tired of that, and Mac fell out with everyone eventually, so people stopped coming, and it was the two of us. Days used to go by and we wouldn't see anyone. We'd do our grocery shopping at the petrol station. It's odd, thinking back on it, but I needed it then. After everything, after Ipswich and all those men, all the things I did, I liked it. Just Mac and me, and the old railway tracks, and the grass, and the dunes, and the restless grey sea. Kamal tilts his head to one side, gives me half a smile. I feel my insides flip.
"It sounds nice, but do you think you are romanticizing the restless grey sea?"
"Never mind that," I say, waving him away. "And no, in any case, have you been to North Norfolk? It's not the Adriatic, it is restless and relentlessly grey." He holds his hand up, smiling.
"Okay."
I feel instantly better, the tension leaching out of my neck and shoulders. I take another sip of the wine. It tastes less bitter now. I was happy with Mac. I know it doesn't sound like the sort of place I'd like, the sort of life I'd like, but Then, after Ben's death and everything that came after, it was. Mac saved me. He took me in, he loved me, he kept me safe, and he wasn't boring. And to be perfectly honest, we were taking a lot of drugs and it's difficult to get bored when you're off your face all the time. I was happy. I was really happy. Kamal nods. I understand, although I'm not sure that sounds like a very real kind of happiness, he says. Not the sort of happiness that can endure, that can sustain you. I laugh. I was 17. I was with a man who excited me, who adored me. I got away from my parents, away from the house where everything reminded me of my dead brother. I didn't need it to endure or sustain. I just needed it for right then.
So what happened?
It seems as though the room gets darker then. Here we are, at the thing I never say. I got pregnant. He nods, waiting for me to go on. Part of me wants him to stop me, to ask more questions, but he doesn't. He just waits. It gets darker still. It was too late when I realized to get rid of it, of her. It's what I should have done had I not been so stupid, so oblivious. The truth is that she wasn't wanted by either of us. Kamal gets to his feet, goes to the kitchen and comes back with a sheet of kitchen roll for me to wipe my eyes. He hands it to me and sits down. It's a while before I go on. Kamal sits, just as he used to in our sessions, his eyes on mine, his hands folded in his lap, patient, immobile. It must take the most incredible self-control, that stillness, that passivity. It must be exhausting. My legs are trembling, my knee jerking as though on a puppeteer's string. I get to my feet to stop it. I walk to the kitchen door and back again, scratching the palms of my hands. We were both so stupid, I tell him. We didn't really even acknowledge what was happening, we just carried on. I didn't go to see a doctor. I didn't eat the right things or take supplements. I didn't do any of the things you're supposed to. We just carried on, living our lives. We didn't even acknowledge that anything had changed. I got fatter and slower and more tired. We both got irritable and fought all the time. But nothing really changed until she came. He lets me cry. While I do so, he moves to the chair nearest mine and sits down at my side so that his knees are almost touching my thigh. He leans forward. He doesn't touch me. But our bodies are close. I can smell his scent. Clean in this dirty room, sharp and astringent. My voice is a whisper. It doesn't feel right to say these words out loud. I had her at home, I say. It was stupid, but I had this thing about hospitals at the time because the last time I'd been in one was when Ben was killed. Plus, I hadn't been for any of the scans. I'd been smoking, drinking a bit. Couldn't face the lectures. I couldn't face any of it. I think, right up until the end, it just didn't seem like it was real, like it was actually going to happen. Mac had this friend who was a nurse, or who'd done some nursing training or something. She came round, and it was okay. It wasn't so bad. I mean, it was horrible, of course, painful and frightening, but then there she was. She was very small. I don't remember exactly what her weight was. That's terrible, isn't it? Kamal doesn't say anything. He doesn't move. She was lovely. She had dark eyes and blonde hair. She didn't cry a lot. She slept well, right from the very beginning. She was good. She was a good girl. I have to stop there for a moment. I expected everything to be so hard. But it wasn't. It's darker still, I'm sure of it, but I look up and Kamal is there. His eyes on mine, his expression soft. He's listening. He wants me to tell him. My mouth is dry, so I take another sip of wine. It hurts to swallow. We called her Elizabeth. Libby. It feels so strange, saying her name out loud after such a long time. Libby, I say again, enjoying the feel of her name in my mouth. I want to say it over and over. Kamal reaches out at last and takes my hand in his. His thumb against my wrist on my pulse. One day we had a fight, Mac and I. I don't remember what it was about. We did that every now and again, little arguments that blew up into big ones. Nothing physical, nothing bad like that, but we'd scream at each other and I'd threaten to leave or he'd just walk out and I wouldn't see him for a couple of days. It was the first time it had happened since she was born. The first time he'd just gone off and left me. She was just a few months old. The roof was leaking. I remember that, the sound of water dripping into buckets in the kitchen. It was freezing cold. The wind driving off the sea, it had been raining for days. I lit a fire in the living room, but it kept going out. I was so tired. I was drinking just to warm up, but it wasn't working, so I decided to get into the bath. I took Libby in with me, put her on my chest, her head just under my chin. The room gets darker and darker until I'm there again, lying in the water, her body pressing against mine, a candle flickering just behind my head. I can hear it guttering, smell the wax, feel the chill of the air around my neck and shoulders. I'm heavy, my body sinking into the warmth. I'm exhausted. And then suddenly the candle is out. And I'm cold. Really cold. My teeth chattering in my head, my whole body shaking. The house feels like it's shaking too. The wind screaming, tearing at the slates on the roof. I fell asleep, I say. And then I can't say any more because I can feel her again. No longer on my chest, her body wedged between my arm and the edge of the tub, her face in the water.
We were both so cold.
For a moment, neither of us move. I can hardly bear to look at him, but when I do, he doesn't recoil from me. He doesn't say a word. He puts his arm around my shoulder and pulls me to him, my face against his chest. I breathe him in and I wait to feel different, to feel lighter, to feel better or worse now that there is another living soul who knows. I feel relieved, I think, because I know from his reaction that I have done the right thing. He isn't angry with me. He doesn't think I'm a monster. I'm safe here, completely safe with him. I don't know how long I stay there in his arms, but when I come back to myself, my phone is ringing. I don't answer it, but a moment later it beeps to alert me that there's a text. It's from Scott. Where are you? And seconds after that, the phone starts ringing again. This time it's Tara. Disentangling myself from Kamal's embrace, I answer. Megan, I don't know what you're up to, but you need to call Scott. He's rung here 4 times. I told him you'd nipped out to the offie to get some wine, but I don't think he believed me. He says you're not picking up your phone. She sounds pissed off, and I know I should appease her. But I don't have the energy. Okay, I say. Thanks. I'll ring him now. Megan, she says. But I end the call before I can hear another word. It's after 10. I've been here for more than 2 hours. I turn off my phone and turn to face Kamal. I don't want to go home, I say. He nods, but he doesn't invite me to stay. Instead, he says, you can come back if you like. Another time. I step forward, closing the gap between our bodies, stand on tiptoe, and kiss his lips. He doesn't pull away from me.
Rachel. Saturday, the 3rd of August, 2013. Morning. I dreamed last night that I was in the woods, walking by myself. It was dusk or dawn, I'm not quite sure. But there was someone else there with me. I couldn't see them. I just knew they were there, gaining on me. I didn't want to be seen. I wanted to run away. But I couldn't. My limbs were too heavy. And when I tried to cry out, I made no sound at all. When I wake, white light slips through the slats on the blind. The rain is finally gone. It's work done. The room is warm. It smells terrible. Rank and sour. I've barely left it since Thursday. Outside, I can hear the vacuum purr and whine. Kathy is cleaning. She'll be going out later. When she does, I can venture out. I'm not sure what I would do. I can't seem to write myself. One more day of drinking, perhaps, and then I'll get myself straight tomorrow. My phone buzzes briefly, telling me its battery is dying. I pick it up to plug it into the charger, and I notice that I have 2 missed calls from last night. I dial into voicemail. I have 1 message.
Rachel, hi, it's Mum. Listen, I'm coming down to London tomorrow, Saturday. I've got a spot of shopping to do. Could we meet up for a coffee or something? Darling, it's not a good time for you to come and stay now. There's... Well, I've got a new friend, and you know how it is in the early stages. She titters. Anyway, I'm very happy to give you a loan to tide you over for a couple of weeks. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Okay, darling? Bye.
I'm going to have to be straight with her. Tell her exactly how bad things are. That is not a conversation I want to have stone cold sober. I haul myself out of bed. I can go down to the shops now and just have a couple of glasses before I go out. Take the edge off. I look at my phone again, check the missed calls. Only 1 is from my mother. The other is from Scott. It's 1:15 in the morning. I sit there with the phone in my hand, debating whether to call him back. Not now. Too early. Perhaps later? After 1 glass, though, not 2. I plug the phone into charge, pull the blind up and open the window, then go to the bathroom and run a cold shower. I scrub my skin and wash my hair and try to quieten the voice in my head, which tells me it's an odd thing to do. Less than 48 hours after your wife's body has been discovered. To ring another woman in the middle of the night. Evening. The earth is still drying out, but the sun is almost breaking through thick white cloud. I bought myself one of those little bottles of wine. Just 1. I shouldn't, but lunch with my mother would test the willpower of a lifelong teetotaler. Still, she's promised to transfer £300 into my bank account, so it wasn't a complete waste of time. I didn't admit how bad things were. I didn't tell her I've been out of work for months, or that I was fired. She thinks her money is tiding me over until my redundancy payment arrives. I didn't tell her how bad things had got on the drinking front, and she didn't notice. Kathy did. When I saw her on my way out this morning, she gave me a look and said, "Oh, for God's sake. Already?" I have no idea how she does that, but she always knows. Even if I've only had 1/2 a glass, she takes 1 look at me, and she knows. "I can tell from your eyes," she says. But when I check myself in the mirror, I look exactly the same. Her patience is running out. Her sympathy, too. I have to stop. Only not today. I can't today. It's too hard today. I should have been prepared for it, should have expected it, but somehow I didn't. I got onto the train, and she was everywhere, her face beaming from every newspaper. Beautiful, blonde, happy Megan looking right into the camera, right at me. Someone has left behind their copy of the Times, so I read their report. The formal identification came last night. The post-mortem is today. A police spokesman is quoted saying that Mrs. Hipwell's cause of death may be difficult to establish,